Today is April 25th, 2016, and this is episode number 357 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin. I'll be your interviewer today. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. If you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Your title is distinctly different this week, Brian.
It is. We're going to do something special. We're going to do an interview. And we actually did this interview and when you couldn't be with us.
Well, I have no doubt that you were able to handle it just superbly on your own.
Yeah, we'll see. But the interview is with John Sculley, former CEO of a little company called Apple. And we talked about a lot of stuff, including a lot of his memories of being at Apple, working with Steve Jobs, some stories I hadn't heard before. We're going to have a written story taking some of the excerpts from this out,
Are you sure you're able to handle this?
No. Taking some of the excerpts from this interview. But for those who want to hear the full interview, here it comes.
And with that in mind, the following interview was conducted by me, Brian Chaffin, with John Sculley on April 11th, 2016.
What do you think your most important accomplishment was while you were at Apple?
Well, I came from a world where becoming number one was a big deal. That's what we did for 10 years during the Cola War, when Pepsi went from a small regional brand to becoming the largest selling soft drink in packaged good soft drink in the United States. And I think that I tried to do two things. One was I tried to stay as true to what Steve Jobs envisioned that the Macintosh would be. And so I was very steadfast that I did not want to move away from beautifully designed products, attention to user experience, and focusing on marketing. And I was voted down at the end, because at that time, Moore's Law, the Windows and Intel were able to do much of the functionality that the Mac could do, and because processors had gotten so powerful by the early 1990s. And there was a lot of sentiment inside of Apple, and was eventually agreed to by the board that we should license the technology. And I was very much against that. I thought it was a huge mistake, because Apple was a design company, and I couldn't see any way that we wouldn't drive the company into incredible losses if we licensed the technology. We'd have to get over a 20% market share, and it just wasn't realistic. Remember, I'm a marketing guy. So I opposed it, and I was eventually pushed out of the company over that. But the accomplishment I did feel good about was by the end of 1992, we'd become the largest selling hardware PC in the world. And from where I had come from, being the largest selling in your industry was what one would strive for. The most important thing, I think, was that Steve Jobs had an amazing ability to see into the future where things were going. When he recruited me to Apple, it was really a big question of everybody in Silicon Valley. Why would they recruit a guy from the soft drink industry, a big world brand marketer, to a technology company? Because at that time, Silicon Valley was all about technology and bits and bytes and performance and building computers that were more powerful than the last generation of computers. And the idea that Steve had was that, no, he was going to take the computer industry in another direction. And his idea was that he would build a creative tool for non-technical people that would be a bicycle for the mind and empower them with creativity applications that would change the way individuals would be able to do all things, from publishing to other types of creative activities. And so when I think about what I did during my tenure at Apple, I didn't invent a new direction for Apple. I tried to follow through as best I was able to on the vision that Steve had laid out. So when he left in 1985, we worked hard to take his vision on publishing. We renamed the Macintosh office Desktop Publishing. We worked closely with Adobe on that. And by 1986, Moore's Law, the processors were fast enough to do the things they couldn't do in 1984 and 1985. And the Macintosh Desktop Publishing became incredibly successful. So Steve's vision was right. He was just premature in terms of the technology wasn't ready in 1984 and 1985. After the desktop publishing, when screens got big and color came in, I was really interested in seeing how much further we could take creativity. And at that time, Steve Perlman, who was a principal scientist at the Apple, had come up with an idea how to do a software decompression engine for multimedia. No one in the world had any such thing. And Steve Perlman created QuickTime. In 1987, Jean-Louis Gasset, who was running product engineering at that time, wanted his engineers to have the experience of what multimedia, interactive multimedia would feel like. It didn't exist in the world anywhere. And so we went out and I approved us buying an XMP48 Cray supercomputer. And we hooked it up to Max, and it enabled the engineers to be able to do real-time interactive rotation and manipulation of 3D geometries. No one had ever been able to do that before. I remember when Sally Ride, who was a director of Apple at the time, tried it, she was amazed. She said she couldn't believe that you could actually manipulate a 3D image. And then I remember when a young entrepreneur came in and met with me, his name was Rob Campbell. I said, Rob, what's your company called? And he said, Forethought. And I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I've got this really interesting application. I said, what's it called? And he said, PowerPoint. And so we invested in it at $11 million valuation. And we introduced desktop presentation, which was the next step that we believe was beyond desktop publishing. And it was all around, you know, Steve's vision. Well, he never articulated desktop presentation, and it was very consistent with the kind of thing he would have done. And then we created a concept video that I worked on with Alan Kay and several other people at Apple. And we created what was called the Knowledge Navigator concept video, which is still out there on YouTube, 1987, Knowledge Navigator. And it was the conception of what a multimedia personal computer would look like 20 years later. And if you look at it today, it looks kind of familiar.
We've talked about that quite a bit on various shows.
Yeah, so there were a lot of things which I think we tried to do that really were part of the vision that Steve Jobs had back in the early 1980s when I first met him. So my argument with Steve was never over the direction or vision that he had, where he wanted to take Apple or the world. It was over the fact that the machines in 1985 just weren't able to do the things that he really thought they should be able to do, desktop publishing. And, you know, that was, as you know, the reason for the breakup between Steve and me.
That makes sense. Do you resent the fact that that there are a lot of people in the Mac faithful who vilify you without taking into account how disruptive and unprofessional Steve could be at that time in his youth?
You know, I really don't lose a lot of sleep over it. I mean, I was there. I know what happened. I know what didn't happen. Steve was imperfect. You know, I was imperfect. And, you know, it is what it is. So my sense is that the board could have played a much more proactive role, and there probably never needed to be a breakup between Steve and me. If you look at what has happened with some very successful companies and some very talented people, I think Facebook is probably one of the best examples, where the founder, even when he was in his 20s, was made the CEO. And the more experienced executive, in this case Sheryl Sandberg, was made the COO. And looking back in hindsight, I said, gee, so why didn't we do something like that at Apple? Steve was the visionary. I wasn't pretending I was, the visionary and could replace him in that. And I was much more pragmatic and more experienced than he was. And my sense is that kind of structure probably would have avoided the big breakup between us. But you can't go back and redo history. There's no makeover. So I just don't worry about it. The reality is that we kept Steve's dream alive throughout the whole 10 years I was at Apple. It was only after I left that they went in a different direction and stopped making beautiful Macintosh designs, licensed the technology to a whole bunch of different companies. And the company almost went bankrupt as a result. So I actually think that I did the best I was able to do. And if it wasn't good enough to make a lot of Mac fanatics happy, there's not much I can do about it. I did the best I could.
Salute, sir. Salute. Were you surprised at how good a manager Steve was after he got back to Apple?
I couldn't believe how good he was, because he really was not a very good manager. When he was young, he had a wonderful ability to simplify everything down to its essence, including how he thought about business planning and how he laid out the plans for the Macintosh factory and things like that. So he had great instincts. I mean, he was a natural. But the reality was, he was not an experienced manager. He made a lot of mistakes. We all make mistakes when we're young. And the Steve Jobs who came back, and whether it was the experience of Next failing, or whether it was the success of Pixar, or he just matured, I don't know. But there was no question that this was a very, very different, more mature guy. And from what I've heard, he still had a lot of the things that made Steve a demanding guy who didn't want any compromises. I mean, all the things that led to great products, that was still Steve. But the reality was he was, a very, very savvy leader at that point in time. And I think we all acknowledge he was the greatest CEO, certainly of our lifetime.
Yes, sir. What do you think the biggest change was in Steve that helped him be more effective?
I don't know. I wasn't there, so I really don't know. But
fair enough.
I could see the results. I mean, Steve always – let's talk about what he was always good at. He was always a terrific recruiter of talent. And as I looked at Apple when he came back, it was starving for talent, and he brought in some really great people. So I give him great high marks for that. Steve was someone who had an ability to articulate things that excited people to want to be on his team. And he had that when he was young, and he had that when he was older. So he never lost that passion. And remember back in the early days, he talked about the Mac being insanely great. Well, he really believed that it was insanely great. And insanely great, it was Steve's vocabulary to say something is just like what you've never seen before. And I think he kept that youthful passion even when he became a mature person. So I have huge respect for him for that. And what I love is that Steve took all of the complicated things that Apple had got themselves into and said, we're just going to focus on doing a few things really, really well. And he didn't panic. He was calm. And he showed, I think, a maturity that the company had to have at that point in time, because the company was in crisis. So however he got that experience and prepared him to take on the role of saving Apple in 1997, I don't think anyone else could have done it except Steve Jobs at that point.
In your book, Moonshot, you talk about the let's take a walk walks,
yeah.
Steve. I would love to hear about your most memorable walk with him.
Well, we actually did it all the time. I mean, we would do it in the Stanford campus. We do it up at Skyline. At one point, Steve was planning to build a house up on a 100-acre site in Skyline, but he couldn't get approvals for it. And Steve didn't like taking no for anything. So he was just absolutely convinced that he could get the government to turn around and let him take land that had been set aside not to be built on by anybody, and that he'd be able to build a house on it. And that's Steve Jobs, right? He never took no as an answer. So Steve and I would hike up there many times just to a skyline up to what's called Windy Hill. And we would do this on Saturdays, and we would look at the views. Steve loved the site because you could look across Windy Hill out to the Pacific Ocean, and you could look across in the east all the way out to the East Bay and down over the Stanford campus. And he said this was his favorite place in the world. He just loved it up there. And it's why we hiked it so many times to that particular place. A very steep hillside. And people used to fly little gas engine airplanes up there. And because it was so windy, they could do all kinds of acrobatics. And Steve loved watching that. It was just a great place to hang out. So I think of all our walks, that was... because we did that one several times. That was a lot of fun. He loved Stanford's campus. We probably covered every pathway on the Stanford campus with the many, many walks we had there. Apple's campus was pretty modest, so it didn't take very long to walk around Apple in that time. Whenever we traveled anywhere, we always shared a room together. And part of it was to sort of show that Apple was frugal in those days, how we spent money. But the other part was it was camaraderie. And so I guess for almost a 3-year period of time, I spent probably more time with Steve than any other person. The reality is Steve didn't care much about friends. He didn't actually have time for friends. And if anyone ever went to his house, they would have seen almost no furniture in his house. You know, he just had a bed, a picture of Einstein, a picture of Mahatma Gandhi, and a Tiffany lamp, and that was it. There wasn't anything else. And that was just fine with him. He had an apartment in New York that we would go to, a triplex, which now belongs to Bono. There was no furniture in it. And he went on for years with no furniture in it. So that was just Steve. He was a total minimalist and not interested in creature comforts at all. We never talked about money. The many times that Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and I were together, there was never discussion about how much money any of us were going to make or how much money the companies were going to make. The thing that surprised me probably more than anything else was here I came out of, at the time, the most competitive industry in the world, the Cola Wars, 10 years in the Cola Wars. And we had actually won the Cola Wars. And then I show up at Apple, and I remember a few months later, and I'm in the Macintosh engineering lab with Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. It's probably, almost midnight because the engineers kind of got going about that time of night. And Steve and Bill are talking about their noble cause. Well, I'd never heard the term noble cause in business before. I came out of the world of businesses, market share, businesses, beating the other person, but it was never about a noble cause. And Bill and Steve, who argued all the time, except on the noble cause, they both agreed the noble cause was to empower knowledge workers with tools for the mind. Steve called them bicycles for the mind, that they would enable individuals to have incredible productivity and to change the world one person at a time. And they absolutely believed that they were going to change the world. But for someone coming from the opposite side of the country who had never heard of Silicon Valley, and to listen to two young guys in their 20s talking about changing the world, nobody in the East Coast in corporate America talked about changing the world, and to talk about a noble cause, it really, probably that was probably the deepest memory in those early days that I had. And even to this day, Brian, you know, I'm still working when most people are retired. I do it not because I have to. I do it because I want to. And I do it because I have a noble cause. And my noble cause is all around healthcare, because I'm convinced that the politicians and the lobbyists have absolutely no chance of improving our healthcare system, because they don't understand innovation, and they don't understand how you can go in and completely rethink a better way of doing something and fundamentally change how we deliver healthcare. And it has nothing to do with government policies and government subsidies and debating and compromising about which policies the government should follow. It has everything to do with how do we take an industry that missed the PC era, that missed the internet, and how do we make sure it doesn't miss the cloud and big data and predictive analytics opportunities that can fundamentally change the way that healthcare is managed. And so that's what really motivates me today. And I would never, I think, would be doing the things I'm doing now if it hadn't been those early conversations with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, you know, going back to the early 1980s.
Interesting. Well, I'm familiar with your work with OBE World Phone. What are you doing in the world of medicine right now?
Well, it's really healthcare more than medicine.
Fair enough.
I mean, I follow what's called precision medicine with a lot of curiosity and interest. And I'm in and around it. That's genomics and proteomics and epigenetics, and particularly CRISPR-Cas9, which is an amazing discovery. It's an editing tool that lets you edit the AGCT DNA code. But that's not really what I do. What I do is focus on the 5% of the population who are chronically ill, who represent 50% of the $3 trillion health spend that we spend every year in the U.S. And I'm absolutely convinced that we can use high technology, many cases technology that's been developed for other industries, almost all of it coming out of Silicon Valley, and be able to reapply that to how you can bring predictive analytics to the chronic care patients and be able to radically change medication therapy management. We're now building the first cloud-based PBM, pharmacy-based management company, and we'll do about $200 million revenue this year. We're looking at several billion dollars of revenue just in the pipeline for next year. So even when we're looking at those kind of large numbers, scaling rapidly, the reality is, even in our wildest success, we'll probably be, 1.5 to 2% share of market, because the healthcare industry is so large. And we're bringing in a lot of analytics and what's called value-based medicine, which for the first time enables care managers working with patients who more and more providers, these are the hospital systems and the payers, the insurance companies, are realizing that they can treat seriously ill chronic care patients with a much higher quality of life at a much lower cost, now that we have digital health and remote monitoring, virtual care, telehealth, the ability to, in our case, we're building what looks like a set-top box. We call it a pill station, and we're able to track all the medications, typically 15 meds a day, that these chronic care patients take. We can manage dosage. We can look at drug interaction. We can really look at avoidable spend on pharmaceutical products, because different specialists are writing scripts, prescriptions for these individuals, and they don't necessarily even talk to one another because there's no interoperability. And so we figured out a way to make all that stuff work, and it's scaling very rapidly. And so there are a lot of things that are going on in healthcare. So I meet regularly with the CEOs of the largest health systems, the payers, the providers, the benefit managers, you know, the whole ecosystem of healthcare. And I'm, I'd say, as deeply involved in the disruptive innovation of healthcare as anything I've ever been involved with, including what I worked on at Apple. And it's a fascinating time. We have one company where, called MD Live, where we're doing virtual care for chronic care patients. We're behavioral therapy for everything from smoking cessation to drug abuse, alcohol dependency, anxiety, depression. You know, the mental health issues are gigantic, particularly for the chronic care population. And these things are very, very solvable in terms of higher quality patient experience and much lower cost delivery. You know, if you bring into the healthcare industry a lot of the same technologies that are being used so successful in fintech and being used in marketing tech and being used in e-commerce and, you know, a lot of these, you know, great success stories that, that are coming out of Silicon Valley and other places.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So you talk a lot about big data and the disruptive nature of big data in your book. And you you did just this wonderful job of describing how the Obama campaign in 2012 was able to use big data to outmaneuver the Romney campaign, for instance. And clearly big data is going to be a big part of healthcare in the future. There's the stuff that you just described. There's the work that IBM is doing with Watson in in healthcare.
So Watson's going to be, someday it's going to be really, really affordable. It's going to be everywhere. And so now it's big, giant systems that are expensive. But, Brian, I can remember, as I said, we bought a $26 million Cray supercomputer. We had 50 MIPS of power with it. You know, when we launched the first color printer, we got it from Textronix. It was a dye sublimation printer. It cost $29,000. So, you know, inevitably, all this technology commoditizes. And so something like Watson that IBM's working on, I think they're very smart to bet the future on cognizant computing, because this stuff is going to become pervasive and mainstream and, you know, very, very reliable and inexpensive, you know, a few years out.
But at the same time, you know, Apple is, I think that's showing Apple thinks that the Apple Watch is going to be really part of that big data in healthcare, play a role in big data with healthcare as well. But there's a dark side to big data, and that is the fact that we have been turned into the product. We've been transformed into the product in ways that humanity has never seen before. What are your views on you know, how do we balance privacy and not looking at us as the commodity in a world where big data becomes ever more important?
Well, you put your finger on it. I mean, there are always unintended consequences. When Robert Sarnoff at the 1939 World's Fair introduced television, and he said that television was going to revolutionize what happened. You know, we saw a whole generation of kids going to school age and spending 55 hours. Actually get a better education.
Mr. Scully, hold on. We've lost connection here. Check one, check two. Can you hear me okay, sir?
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay, you're back. Go ahead,
okay, please. So I was just saying that there are always unintended consequences with revolutionary technology. And we saw it with television. And we are even seeing it today with kids who on average spend about, these are the millennials, you know, particularly the teenagers, and they're spending about 11 hours a day, you know, on screens, some kind of screen. You know, it could be a screen on your wrist, it could be a screen in your hand, it could be a screen on the wall. So we don't know whether that's good or bad. And the point you bring about we have really surrendered ourselves to becoming data, and we don't even know who owns us. You know, we don't know whether we own us. We don't know whether somebody else owns us. You can obviously see the opportunities for incredible good. I mean, healthcare is a perfect example of that. We have to build systems that are HIPAA compliant, so we have to follow very rigorous regulations. But there's a lot of the activity that goes on with data where there are no regulations. You know, there are no guideposts. And the reality is we really don't know what we're surrendering ourselves to. So you make a very good point, and I don't have a good answer for it. It's just one of those things we're going to have to learn how to cope with.
Is Apple the anomaly in that Apple is the one company not trading on big data? That, you know, they're the biggest company in the world right now. Is Apple the anomaly, or is there other chances for other companies to do big shot moonshots that don't involve making us the product?
You know, I don't know. I'm not connected with Apple, so I don't know what's going on in their thinking. Apple has, as you point out, not tried to build a business around data to the extent that other people have tried to build business around data. Apple has stayed true to what Steve's vision was he wanted to build really cool products, and Apple still builds really cool products without compromises in fit, finish, materials, user experience, all of those things. And I think that's what Apple does best. Apple doesn't try to be the first at doing anything. They try to be the best at whatever they do. And so it does give Apple a chance to kind of let other people be out on the bleeding edge on issues like how do you deal with data? I mean, whether it's Facebook or Google or Amazon or any number of other companies that are much more aggressive in how they use data than Apple is. I just don't think it's what Apple's DNA is about. They are not trying to be the world's most innovative engineering company. They never have. They're much more focused on being the company that builds the coolest products in the world that everybody wants. You know, we used to say at Apple, we sell to the people who love us. So Apple has a huge respect for its customers, and it knows that it's going to be held to a much higher standard by anyone else, by its customers than any other company is. So I think they have been completely consistent with what Steve was interested in when he was alive, to focus on building products with no compromise, focus on building amazing user experiences, but really not making a big strategy out of data. So it's kind of ironic that the FBI decides to go after Apple, you know, the one company who isn't trying to use data in some way, as you suggest, and they go after Apple to give the FBI a backdoor into the iPhone, which you can imagine the implications in China if Apple said, we've given the FBI a backdoor into the iPhone.
Oh, yeah. We've written and spoken about that topic at the Mac Observer extensively. Do you wear an Apple Watch?
No, I don't.
Do you use an iPhone as your daily driver?
I love the iPhone. My favorite product is the new iPad Pro. I think it's terrific. It's not, a particularly big seller, but the screen is great. I read my newspapers and, anything that I need to read, I read off of the iPad Pro. I draw. Steve couldn't draw, so he would have me do sketches of things, and I could draw because I went to the Royal School of Design. And I went to graduate school of architecture at Penn too. And so I love what you can do on an iPad Pro. I love my iMacs. You know, we have probably, I guess, 6 iMacs between my wife, Diane, and I. And we have all kinds of Apple products. Diane has an Apple Watch, and she thinks it's beautiful. It just doesn't do anything that's particularly important in my life. So maybe someday it will. So I don't question how beautifully it's designed. It just isn't a product that I thirst for the way I did for an iPad Pro or an iMac.
Understood. All right, well, the last question I'll leave you with is, like I said, it's been 2 years since Moonshot came out, not quite 2 years. Has anything in the landscape, the technology landscape, changed that makes you want to temper or emphasize any particular point in the book?
Well, I would have to, if I were going to write the book again, I would have to talk about CRISPR-Cas9. And CRISPR-Cas9 is the editing tool for DNA. So we have deoxynucleic acid, which is the AGCT, you know, code that Crick and Watson discovered back in 1953, and then Craig Venter did the first human genome sequence in 2000, and now Illumina. That cost $2.3 billion, and now Illumina is able to do it for $1,000, you know, sequence a human gene. But all of that is about discovery of DNA. Then along comes two brilliant people, you know, one from the Broad Institute at MIT, who is Feng Shuang, who's Chinese, and the other was Jennifer Doudna, who's out of Berkeley. And between the two of them, they discovered the editing tool, which is the a derivative of the RNA, the ribonucleic acid, that enables you to take like a scissor, which is what CRISPR is the acronym for, that lets you go in and snip the DNA string. And the Cas9 is a protein that gives you the control over the direction of where it's going to actually make it snip. And that discovery is fundamentally changing everything that we know in genomics. And so right now, people are working on material science, which is going to enable incredibly new materials from you know, being able to build synthetic organs to being able to build new types of military aircraft, which will use material science that was never possible before. Craig Venter, the man who did the first human genome sequence in 2000, is now developing a non-fossil fuel energy that's being built from yeast, which is one of the two cells that have been fully decoded. And now with CRISPR-Cas9, they're actually able to go in and edit it. And it's looking very realistic. They'll be able to build a non-fossil fuel. If you look at what's going on in the ability to build you know, all kinds of new precision medicine ways to deal with everything from Parkinson's to MS to people eventually hope even Alzheimer's, the ability to go in and edit the DNA of people and to get the DNA to correct a mutation. I mean, the world of medicine is moving from the practice of medicine to the science of medicine. And the big theme that I had in my book, Moonshot, was I talked about, because I'm a marketing guy, I talked about the power shift that's already taken place that has shifted power from incumbent large organizations that have dominated industry sectors for decades. And suddenly, even with great reputations and huge marketing budgets, people are paying more attention to the opinions of other people than they are to the reputations and the marketing campaigns of even the largest companies. And the result is that we're seeing an entirely new generation of businesses that are transforming industry after industry. And it explains why companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon are able to build these huge businesses without spending any advertising money. You know, it's customers listening to the opinions of other customers, and it goes viral and scales, you know, incredibly. And so this isn't a prediction of the future, Brian. This has already happened. And so what fascinates me, because I'm not a computer engineer, though I've been in the high-tech industry for 33 years, I look at the derivative effects of technology, because I assume that all technology ultimately commoditizes. And so you have to have, you know, people like Steve Jobs, and hopefully there'll be others. You know, Elon Musk would be a good example of that, who see the future. You know, a genius in my mind is seeing the obvious 20 years ahead of the rest of us. Clearly, Steve Jobs had that that ability. And so now when you take something like CRISPR-Cas9, and we're in the world of synthetic biology, and the ways to think about what we can build with the science of biology, and that biology used to be chemistry. And now biology is information science as much as it is chemistry. So there are just some amazing things that are going to happen in this century. And I probably would be talking about that, but not as a scientist, because I'm not a scientist. I'd be talking about as a marketing person and the derivative effects of how do you change, you know, what is marketing? Marketing is you know, how products you know, impact the lives of people, and how do you make it interesting and compelling? And so I think that there are going to be some amazing, compelling things that are going to come out of the world of biologics.
Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Sounds cool. Nice to talk to you, Brian.
Mr. Scully, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for your time.
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. Thanks for joining us for this interview with John Scully. If you'd like to comment on, add, or question anything, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
And hey, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.